Hi, I'm Joy Manning, editor of Edible Philly.
And I'm Marisa McClellan, author of Food in Jars.
Welcome to Local Mouthful. We're here to talk about living the food life in Philadelphia and beyond. This week we're talking about miso glazed salmon, smoothie season, and local corn tortillas. But first, let's compare notes on something we read this week. I came across a study that was reported in a story in the Smithsonian Magazine titled Feeling Down? Science says cooking and baking can help you feel better. Again, not very surprising to you and me, but no. Something I want the world to know.
It's true. I'm a big believer in the idea that, especially for me, cooking a meal or just doing something when I feel stuck or I'm down or I just feel like I need a lift, you know, heading to the kitchen and doing something, starting a loaf of bread, you know, starting something for dinner, changes my mood. It's a mood elevator without any sort of mind-altering drugs.
This story was based on a study published recently in the Journal of Positive Psychology, and it posited that there are two reasons that cooking or baking has this effect. One of them is the fact that it's creative, and that creative behaviors, creative activities contribute to human happiness and flourishing, which seems obviously true to me.
Yeah.
And the other one is mindfulness, because when you're cooking, it sort of requires you to be present. And, you know, there's an increasing body of research that suggests mindful activities and mindfulness periods of any sort help our brains just feel better and work better.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's really interesting. I feel like these are things that if we thought about it a little bit, we might not even need scientific studies
right
to tell us. But it's always nice to have the research backing up.
You and I cook a lot, so we know this firsthand.
Yeah.
But as you also know, there are tons of people that don't cook at all. And not only don't cook, consider cooking to be a drag.
Yeah.
Or an unpleasant experience. So I think it's important to look at stuff like this to try to remind people, hey, cooking is fun. Cooking makes you feel better. Cooking is creative. Cooking is play.
Well, and, you know, just from my own personal experience, the last couple of weeks, I haven't done a lot of cooking. You know, it was, you know, I would make a salad and we'd throw some store-bought cooked chicken on top or something like that. And I was really starting to feel off mm-hmm. and disconnected. And so I had a friend stay over on Monday and I made food. You know, it wasn't fancy food, but I made, you know, a whole meal. And by the end, I felt so much more like myself again. Mm-hmm. I just felt like, ah, okay, this is, you know, when I'm doing things that are more assembly or I'm, you know, getting takeout, it is not as soothing and satisfying. And I start to lose some aspect of myself.
I experienced that too. I mean, when I was without a kitchen for weeks and weeks, I definitely didn't feel like myself. And it was even the small cooking projects that I was first able to do that helped make me feel like my new house was home.
Yeah.
And that I was me, you know, and that my days had sort of a predictable pattern.
Well, and I think on the baking side, you know, people have, you know, turning to baking for comfort is a time-tested and, you know, well-loved coping mechanism. You know, I feel like when you're a kid, if you're feeling down, helping your mom make some cookies, that, you know, that really can help you feel better because it is this sort of like physical, tangible expression of love.
Right. Not mentioned in this story, but true for me at least, is the idea that when you're cooking, you have control. Like in the world, it feels very out of my control. Sometimes my work feels out of my control. Friends and loved ones, things sometimes seem out of my control, but in the kitchen, things are in my control.
Yeah.
And I can bend ingredients to my will and make something useful and necessary. And that gives me a feeling of being self-possessed, being powerful, being able to direct my own life that can sometimes, you know, follow me out of the kitchen.
Yeah, I'm right there with you.
So we'll put a link to the story in the show notes. Let us know if you agree, if you've experienced this. Take a look at the story. We want to know what you think.
Yeah.
All right. What's for dinner this week?
Yeah, tell me, Joy.
As I sort of hinted at last time, I have a new cookbook in my arsenal. It's Melissa Clark's book, Dinner.
Yeah, I've gazed at that one longingly at the bookstore, but I have not
acquired it.
Uh-uh.
I don't know how you feel about Melissa Clark and her recipes in general.
For the most part, I like Melissa Clark. She has given me some really brilliant inspiration at times. I don't necessarily always follow her recipes to the T, but I feel like she is one of the most creative people cooking and writing about it these days.
There is something that I don't exactly relate to in her tone and in her persona.
Yeah.
There's something about her head notes that feels very cool for me or something. However.
Yeah.
And this feeling makes me disinclined to like her recipes. But her recipes are so good.
Yeah.
Like so infuriatingly good that I have to keep reading her and buying her cookbooks and making her recipes. Like I've almost never had one turn out in a way that I didn't like.
Well, and she was the one who originated your favorite like tofu stir fry too with the grated tofu.
Shredded tofu. Yeah. There are several recipes on that theme in the book that are, I haven't made them all yet, but really good looking. Anyway, so when I got on my pea green or my pea tips kick, which we talked about last time, I was looking for like a miso something recipe. I love miso. And I look through, I have like a lot of recent cookbooks actually, because now I have shelves. So I also have Diana Henry's Simple and the new Food 52 dinner book.
Yeah.
I have a lot to say about these three books actually, but that's for another time.
We'll have that conversation.
So I was looking through all of them for something miso-y, and she calls it a minimalist recipe for miso glazed salmon. It had miso, ginger, brown sugar, mirin. And so I made the marinade exactly as instructed. But then I sous vide the fish.
Oh.
She has you bake the fish a bit and then – or no, I'm sorry. She has you broil it a few minutes on each side. So I sous vide the fish until it was like just below the doneness that I want it, and then I broiled it just to make the glaze sort of like thickened and bubbly and a bit crisp, and it was so good.
Did you sous vide it with the glaze on it, so you packed
it's like a marinade it's like a marinade that turns into a glaze.
Okay.
So and fish, actually, it was my first time using the immersion circulator to cook fish. It goes pretty quick, like this was like an hour start to finish.
That is quick.
So, and it was like just perfectly textured salmon. It was so good. I used, we've talked on the show before about how much I struggle to find fish that I feel okay about cooking. Ippolito's, which is a fishmonger in South Philly, carries this farm-raised salmon called Verlasso, which is a eco-conscious, sustainable, environmentally friendly, or as much as they can be for a farmed fish product. So that's what I use. I still have not gotten to Costco. I don't know when this is going to happen for me.
We might just have to have a field trip, Joy.
It's so frustrating. I've been so, you know how it's been like when you move and you're working a lot. But that's where I'm hoping to find my supply, lifetime supply of frozen fish.
Yeah.
But yeah.
So do you feel like this miso glazed application could go on other things as well?
Yeah. At a later date, I made eggplant with this glaze. Okay. It would be terrific on any other fish, tofu, chicken. I think that's what I originally had in my mind, was like a miso glazed chicken thigh when I started thinking of something to go with the greens. But I ended up on salmon, and it was just like so good. Like as I was eating it, I was saying to Dan, this is the best thing I've made since we moved. I want to make this again tomorrow.
That is so satisfying when that happens.
I know. It is satisfying. And it just – is it you or Scott? Do you both like salmon or neither? Oh, good. So you have to try it.
Okay, I will.
I might be willing to lend you a copy of the book, my copy of the book, so you can try it.
I might have to get that book too, so we'll see.
It is really, I recommend it wholeheartedly and without reservations, in spite of how skinny Melissa Clark is. How off-puttingly perfect her family appears. Anyways,
you just have to remember it's all image.
I know. I actually, there's like one particularly galling photo in this book, and I was like, just imagine what they're fighting about when, you know, no, there are no cameras are there. Like, just imagine their arguments. Like, I bet you that kid throws a lot of tantrums. I have to take this to a therapist instead. let's move on.
All right.
It's smoothie season.
Hooray.
I love smoothies.
Me too. And I definitely, in the last maybe 3 or 4 weeks, I've been making a lot of them.
Yes, I get my Vitamix out and going on full speed ahead.
Yeah.
Now, first I want to say, when you say the word smoothie, a lot of people think of like a Jamba Juice smoothie or like a prepared food smoothie. I hate those smoothies. They're always too sweet.
Yeah.
They're always chock full of sugar.
Absolutely.
And I make my smoothies with no artificial ingredients and no sweetened yogurt.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm right there with you.
No, like, sweeteners, no sugar, no honey. If I need a little extra jolt of sweetness, I will throw in a date.
Yeah, that's exactly what I do.
What are your favorite smoothie formulas or ingredients?
So my basic smoothie formula is I start with 2 cups of water and like a palmful of raw cashews. I weighed it out once and it was like 1/2 ounce of cashews into the water. And if I think I'm going to need extra sweetener, I throw a pitted date in there as well. And then I add whatever fruit I have around. So often a frozen banana, maybe a peeled orange, maybe a chopped apple, something like that. I almost always have a banana.
And I love that frozen banana.
Yeah,
smoothie.
It's really good. And then I typically use baby spinach and I cram a ton of it in there. So today I made a smoothie and I had an brand new 8 ounce bag of baby spinach and I used 1/2 of it. Mm-hmm. And then I will top it with like 3 or 4 ice cubes and one more kind of frozen fruit, typically blueberries. So
I don't usually put ice cubes in, but I sometimes double up on the frozen fruit. Just as I love plain organic frozen vegetables, I love plain organic frozen fruit. And I especially like mangoes. Frozen mango chunks for smoothies are wonderful.
Frozen pineapple is also a great one.
Frozen cranberry will give it a little sweet tart kick.
I don't do that. That's fun.
Okay, so you make yours creamy with cashews.
Yeah.
Do you use yogurt?
Almost never.
Oh, I like a yogurt smoothie.
I do too, but I feel like with the cashews, it's always something I have around. Mm-hmm. And so it just becomes like an easy formula. Mm-hmm. And then also, you know, feeling like, well, we live in a world where I could probably do to not have a vegan meal, you know, on a fairly regular basis, it's a place where I can do that and not miss the dairy.
Yes. And do you always add some greens?
Always.
I sometimes do a green smoothie, sometimes not.
My feeling is if I'm going to make a smoothie, I might as well sort of cram in as much nutrition as possible.
What else besides spinach do you like for a green smoothie?
I do kale. Baby kale works better because it blends up a little bit better. I have done Swiss chard in the past and it is a strong flavor.
I do that too. Sometimes I accept that my green smoothie is going to be a little vegetal.
Yeah. And then I have done lettuce at times when I have lettuce that needs to be used up, especially like in CSA season when you're getting 3 or 4 heads of lettuce. And so those are my primary greens. I know that some people like to put things like frozen cauliflower or avocado in their smoothies. And I don't really do that.
I like avocado in lieu of the cashews or the frozen banana.
My feeling is that it is a waste to put an avocado in a smoothie because I just want the deliciousness of the avocado. I want, when I'm going to eat an avocado, I want to really know that I'm experiencing it.
Did I tell you that my local bodega in South Philly that always had ripe avocados for sale has closed and I have not had a ripe avocado at home since then?
Oh, no.
Very, very sad.
That is sad.
Do you buy like a bag at the store and then let them ripen on your counter?
I do sometimes, although that's often a disaster.
I got so spoiled over the years with like this ripe avocado on demand out the front door thing.
DeBruno Brothers, the one at 18th and Chestnut, often has nearly ripe avocados. Mm-hmm. They're a little bit more expensive than other places. They were like $2 for $5. But knowing that they're at the cusp of ripeness and I can buy them and often use them the next day, I often splurge.
Yeah. What about, let's call them functional add-ins.
I don't do any of that stuff.
I add flax.
Do you? Mm-hmm. I struggle with flax.
Not every time, but
to me, flax actually changes the flavor of things. Mm-hmm. And it changes the texture. And so I feel like I just want to enjoy my smoothie. But I get why you would add it.
I sometimes add flax.
Yeah.
The omega-3s. It's full of fiber. I have it.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. You know, if I have a particular, if I think it's going to be a really runny smoothie, I might throw some chia seeds in there just to help it. But like the problem with chia seeds is that then they become gelatinous. Mm-hmm. And so if you don't drink that smoothie fast.
Yeah, you have to get the exact right number of seeds in there to keep it from being gooey.
But I mean, I love a smoothie. When I was a kid, my dad always made smoothies, but his were sort of more functional. So he would, you know, it would be a meal replacer where it would be a little bit of milk, a banana, some protein powder and some ice cubes and maybe a scoop of peanut butter.
I was going to say, you know what I like instead of protein powder? Peanut butter.
I will say I sometimes do a dessert smoothie, like if I'm feeling hungry still, where it'll be frozen banana, a couple of dates, a scoop of unsweetened cocoa powder.
Oh, I do this same thing, but I call it a milkshake in my mind. I have it after dinner. That's funny.
It's really good.
Okay, we're going to do something now that is a little overdue. I'm going to convince you to join me for lunch at South Philly Barbacoa.
Okay.
We've talked about South Philly Barbacoa on the show before.
Yeah.
It has had many accolades. You know it's delicious, but I'm going to get you where you live now and talk about the local food and farming aspect that's going on here. And you will probably meet me there tomorrow.
All right. Sounds good.
All right. So for those who don't know, South Philly Barbacoa is a tiny taco stand or taco storefront where they just basically do two types of lamb-based tacos. And the meat, the barbacoa itself has been much discussed, but what has been less discussed is the tortillas themselves, which they make in-house. I didn't exactly know all the details of this until I went to a class on the subject at the Free Libraries Culinary Literacy Center.
Oh, wow.
So let me just tell you a little bit about how they do it.
Please do.
Are you familiar with Colton Organics Farm in Lancaster, PA?
I sure am. Tom Colton.
So Tom last year grew 13 tons of corn from heirloom Mexico seeds specifically for South Philly Barbacoa.
Wow.
Okay. So, and as a side note, they're now growing chickpeas so that they also do this consomme from the lamb drippings, which is like a delicious broth with chickpeas in it. So now Colton Organics is growing chickpeas for them too. But back to the corn.
Yeah.
So the corn dries right on the cob in the field on the farm, which is how they do this in Mexico. And then it's delivered to South Philly Barbacoa, the dried whole cobs. Then the kernels are, mixed with water and a lime solution to nixtamalize them.
Yep.
Which softens the hull and makes more of the nutrition bioavailable. And then they're cooked and it's so the whole mess soaks overnight.
Okay.
Okay, in the morning, they grind this on a stone mill that they had imported from Mexico. And when you grind this, moist, fresh mixture, you get a dough. Like, you don't get a flour, you get a dough. And from this dough that is just corn, basically, they roll out over 2,000 – I shouldn't say roll out. They're hand-shaped and pressed. They're 10 grams each. Pressed in an old-fashioned tortilla press and cooked on the skillet there to the tune of 2,000 of these a day.
Oh, my God.
This is incredible, right?
That is amazing.
And when you taste these tortillas, it is life-changing. It's like, remember when we thought those tortillas that they make fresh and sell in the Italian market were good?
Yeah.
I mean, now those are acceptable and the ones that you buy at the store are inedible. You wow. have to come eat this. It is okay. so alive with corn flavor. It's so supple. It's almost and at the library, they made it with a vegetarian version of the uh-huh. taco filling. It was it really let the tortilla itself shine.
Oh, that sounds
you
so
will
good.
Freak out.
When did you take this class?
A couple Mondays ago.
Wow.
I really decided on a spur of the moment to go. I don't know what got into me. I kind of knew that they were doing this themselves there. I knew that someone was growing the corn for them locally, but I really wanted to go do a deep dive and learn yeah. all about it. It's just really a special thing they're doing. It's so – what I love most about it is it's so – I hate to use the word authentic, but, Ben and Christina are the chefs behind it. Christina is from Mexico.
Yeah.
And it's authentic to what they do in Mexico. But – it's also so local.
Yeah.
Because they're starting with local corn from our fields here in Lancaster and local lamb. And it's a very local interpretation of this super traditional Mexican dish. And it is everything that you have heard it is and more.
Amazing. So are they doing all this in that small storefront in South Philly?
Yes. You would not believe the number of – they did it. They did part of it. They didn't do the soaking and the nixtamalization of the corn. But they did bring the dough, and Christina rolled, pressed, and cooked dozens of tortillas in a one-hour period.
Wow.
For the class at the library. And I think they have a couple of other people that help them do it, and it is really, really neat. I don't know. I hope that I've – well, on the one hand, I live – very close by there, and I like to go there on Friday. I've been going there on Friday to have tacos for lunch, whether I can get somebody to go with me or not, to be frank. And every time it's like, I forgot how delicious this is. But there's not that many places to sit down. It's always crowded. Like, sometimes you have to sit with strangers. This doesn't bother me at all.
Well, I mean, you also live so close, you could get yours and go home.
That's true. But they do this nice little bar of, like, fixings and, like, guacamole and, like, three types of salsa and sometimes some salads. So it's just really nice. Like, I really don't. If you're free for lunch, you should come tomorrow.
All right.
As I mentioned, I had an appointment to go there with one of our other friends, one of our other mutual friends, but that was rescheduled for next Friday. So,
all right, I'm in.
I need a barbacoa date for tomorrow.
We'll do it. I'll report back.
Or, you know, not that I need one. But it's always, it's always fun to show it off to other people, which it sounds like a dumb thing because, like, you have obviously heard some of this before, right? I mean, I have
heard of South Philly barbacoa. I didn't realize the extent to which it was local.
You know that they were on Bon Appetit's Best Restaurants in America
list. Yeah, I did know that.
It's like, sometimes I think places get like that, get on that list as like a gimmick or like because it's a cool story.
Yeah.
And I didn't, obviously Ben and Christina are big advocates for the right to work for immigrants, which is all important work. And a lot of the attention has been on that. And it is worthy of attention. But from my perspective as a food writer, like, this food is independent of that story. Like, this food is incredibly delicious, incredibly local, really fresh. And as I was saying earlier, I like things that are traditional, and this is like that. They've been doing it this way in Mexico for, you know, probably thousands of years, and it's a very specific thing that has, to me now, two senses of place.
So here's a question, because one of the issues that's been in the news lately or in the sort of the food media is how food that is sort of ethnic, for lack of a better word, people aren't willing to pay as much. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, this is an immense amount of work and time and energy for this food. Do you feel like they're charging what it's worth? Or
the tortillas the tacos are $4 each. It feels like a bargain to me.
But I mean, it's certainly more expensive than like the taco truck down the street.
I don't know what those tacos cost, to be honest. I guess, what do you get, like $5 for three or something like that?
I feel like the going rate for like a cheap taco would be like 2 for $7. Mm-hmm. So I guess, I mean, they're not far off of that price.
It's not, to me, it seems like they could charge, it seems like they could charge more, but I know that they don't want to exclude people either, you know?
Yeah.
Their intended audience is not just people like me, but also people like Christina when she first came to this country and wanted to have a taste of home, but maybe didn't have the resources to spend a ton of money. It's really, I don't know. I want you to have it.
I will. We will do it.
Tell me about your tomatoes.
So I shop at the Rittenhouse Square Farmers Market a lot. And last week, or I guess 2 weeks ago when this airs, it was the first week that the Hands on Earth folks had their hothouse tomatoes, which obviously, you know, it's May. That's a little early for local tomatoes, but every year they start seeds the day after Christmas and grow these hothouse tomatoes so that they have them for the start of farmers market season. And they are good. They are good tomatoes, especially when you have gone a whole, you know, 6 months without any sort of, you know, resemblance of a delicious fresh tomato.
Is it like a full-size tomato or a grape tomato?
It is a full-size tomato. It's like a beefsteak.
Huh.
And I love them. And they're just flavorful and good. And they, you know, this is a family farm where they're really putting a lot of love and energy into it. And so it's just such a pleasure in early May to go to the farmer's market and be greeted with tomatoes when all else you see is some greens, some rhubarb. You know,
do you happen to know, do they sell at Head House?
I don't know. I don't think they go to Head House, but I don't think they do a lot of farm or markets in Philadelphia except for the Rittenhouse Square one. But if you are hungry for tomatoes and you live in Philadelphia, I would highly suggest, and they're not expensive. I think they charge $2.50 or $3 a pound for these really delicious, ripe, rosy, locally grown tomatoes. You know, the other thing is that hot house tomatoes that you buy where you don't know where they came from. They're often, people are exploited to right. grow those. There's no exploitation happening. This is a family farm in Lancaster County. And they are good tomatoes.
What have you been doing with them?
I am so starved for tomatoes that I have simply been buying a really good loaf of bread at Metropolitan, toasting it, rubbing it with a little, you know, fresh garlic clove and drizzling it with olive oil and then cutting them thick and laying them on the toast and sprinkling it with salt.
Sounds good.
It's so good. So good. And for, you know, tomatoes, I spent years where I didn't eat tomatoes when I was a kid because I had an allergy.
Hmm.
So I feel like I have spent my adult life making up for lost tomato time. And so these give me a little edge. I get a little bit more into the season. And then I start doing things like making a lunchtime salad with some chopped red onion and some chickpeas and feta cheese and these tomatoes and some cucumber and olive oil.
You would never think of canning them though, right?
No, no. They're too expensive and too precious to can. But they are perfect for this early season when we, you know, when everybody is so hungry for something fresh and ripe and juicy.
It's true. It is true. I'm really, we're recording this ahead of time and I'm really excited about going to the Head House opening day this weekend.
Me too.
I'm going to take your advice and be there first thing.
It's the best way to do it.
Maybe there'll even be some hot house tomatoes.
There very well may be. But I would say if you are someone who is hungry for a local tomato, get yourself to the Rittenhouse Square Farmers Market and buy some tomatoes. And they will have, then they have, you know, field grown tomatoes later in the season. These folks also bring really delicious peaches. So they're a reliable farm. Like they're one of my regulars, but early season tomatoes, that's where it's at.
Well, that's it for this week's installment of The Local Mouthful. Thank you, Dan Call, for editing the show, to Saul Rosenbaum for designing our logo, and Raina Rose for providing the music. And thank you, Philly Camp, for providing our studio space. If you like what you hear, please subscribe via iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Local Mouthful. Get our newsletter, catch up on past episodes, and check out our show notes at localmouthful.com. Until next time, happy eating.